there. I've seen it firsthand. It is completely fake news. And as you said, people can just surf the internet and see what Tehran and other cities in Iran look like.
Yeah, I've been there twice too. And in the north of Tehran, women are wearing hats instead of, and nobody's, you know, impounding them. Police is right there and nothing's going on. So you don't even need to really ask people. Just do a little bit of research on your own outside of these obviously biased sources.
Definitely.
So lastly, the foreign policy piece claims that Iran is regularly ranked as one of the worst countries to be a woman in terms of gender parity for economic opportunities, education, health concerns, and political leadership. Guess according to whom, Marwa? According to research by the World Bank and the World Economic Forum, WEF. So that was coming from an American news publication, the same America that does not only suppress women, but now has given the right for men to identify as women while knowing fully well that education and health care are completely free for all Iranian citizens, unlike the USA, where they wrote these dishonest lines about Iranian women.
Wow. I mean, the audacity, especially of these organizations who continue to control many sovereign states but have never been able to control the Iranian state, for that matter, claim that all these fake news about Iran just to play with words and brainwash the public. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and they want to begin with their current control of Iran by controlling women, which they haven't been able to do.
Despite the fact that women in Iran have their rights met years ago, some rights that are not even found in the West. But I want to thank you very much, our mainstream media expert in this segment, Ms. Julia Qasim, for joining us to talk about this pressing matter that we always see whenever there's something happening in Iran, especially if it's elections. Thank you for your contribution, dear Julia. And now, ladies and gents, we move on to social media expose. Another topic that was center stage last week, especially on social media platforms, was the airdrop charade of aid and expired food on Gaza residents and the famine caused by the ongoing Zionist-Israeli genocide. Here is Sima Itaim, our social media expert and editor at The Cradle, with more.
Thank you, Marwa. So airdropping aid, much like a placebo, it might make people feel better if they're watching, people who are watching from afar. But at the end of the day, it's a showy PR exercise and it's inadequate. It's pathetically inadequate.
I hear you.
It's useless to the point where it becomes a metaphor and not more for the abject failure of the international community to muster up any kind of meaningful response to such an immense, unprecedented humanitarian tragedy.
I second that. Definitely.
So for the first post, we have a post by Big Brother 7 who criticizes these airdrops, saying, reports from Gaza say the airdrops of today weren't enough for 100 people. For reference, there are hundreds of thousands of starving people in northern Gaza, with many children already dying due to hunger. The airdrops are just a cruel charade at this point.
I second his opinion. I mean, people who see my Twitter can see that I was very vocal about this, so I'm not going to stop you anymore.
Right. We knew. I mean, we could tell from the beginning. And then the aid killed some civilians.
Yes, exactly. So
it got even worse than what we had expected. For the second post, we have by Quds News Network that quotes the Gaza government media office reporting that the situation of famine is deteriorating, with 2.4 million people experiencing severe food shortages and airdrops, which have proven to be futile.
Oh, my God.
So along with this post, Quds News Network attaches a photo with a quotation from the Gaza government media office saying that dropping aid from the air and avoiding its entry through the crossings circumvents the root solutions to the problem.
Definitely. I mean, the border is there. Open the border, for the love of God.
Where there are thousands of trucks, not just hundreds, waiting to be let through. We have another post by Asaf, MD, on X, saying that not only is the amount of aid being airdropped completely insufficient, the most vulnerable of Gaza's civilian population will be unable to access the aid. So he attached a video where a care representative in Ramallah tells Sky News that these airdrops make it impossible for people with disabilities to remain alive.
First of all, there is the issue of accuracy, there is the issue of being so expensive, the limited number that they will have, and the limited content. So it's only meals, while the needs are massive. And most importantly, you only those who can reach physically strong to reach to these aid will be getting them. So women, elderly, women-headed household, people with, unfortunately, disabilities will not be among those that are going to access the aid.
So even people with disabilities are finding it hard to get the least amount of aid in Gaza.
Yeah, the minimum. We have another post on X from a Gaza resident who is currently displaced to southern Gaza with his family. Maysara at whatever 2067, laying it out as it is. Jordan complicity turns Gaza into a hunger game where people have to fight and even get killed to get food. Israel wanted this and Jordan airdrops did the job.
Sadly said by a Gazan who is a resident of Gaza displaced to Rafah. And I think the people that we should hear the most are the Palestinian people in Gaza and no one else outside that besieged area. Mm-hmm.
So now in response to the World Health Organization's report entitled Gaza Worst Famine Fears Realized as 10th Child Reportedly Starves to Death, mm-hmm. Michael Fakhri, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, posted, Israel has been intentionally starving the Palestinian people in Gaza since October 8. Now famine may very well be already occurring. The only way to end, prevent this famine is an immediate ceasefire. And the only way to get a ceasefire is to sanction Israel. Wow. So that was a first, mm-hmm. I think, Marwa. We see a UN rapporteur calling for sanctioning the Israeli entity. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've seen that before. Mm-hmm. In order to reach a ceasefire, this is kind of coming to terms with reality, finally realizing that there is no other way around this.
Definitely. Even we were listening a bit from the Biden administration, certain officials saying that they don't condone what's happening, yet they don't have the power to change it, which we really don't believe. But listening to this, having this voice out in the open, especially on social media, is something unprecedented indeed, and all for the sake of Palestinians in Gaza. Thank you very much, Seema, for
Thank
your
you,
contribution
Mara.
And telling us what happened on X, especially on X this time, because it was a very heated discussion concerning whether aid was actually helping the Palestinians or not. Thank you for being here and for your analysis. Now, ladies and gents, we move on to Figures Exposé. The overwhelming majority of civilians in Gaza are dependent on direct assistance from the UNRWA agency, which is also a critical lifeline for other aid organizations working inside Gaza that rely on its aid infrastructure to distribute support. However, a recent opinion poll shows that the majority of the Israeli entity settlers oppose the transfer of humanitarian aid to Palestinian people in the besieged Gaza Strip, where the occupying regime has been waging a genocidal war since October 2023. The findings were published in a survey conducted by the so-called Israel Democracy Institute, saying over two out of the three Jewish Israeli settlers, which accounted for 68% of respondents, disapprove of the transfer of humanitarian aid to Gaza residents at this time, while a large 85% majority of Arab respondents in occupied Palestine supported. Now, when asked, do you support or oppose the idea that Zionist Israel should allow the transfer of humanitarian aid to Gaza residents at this time, with food and medicine being transferred by international bodies that are not linked to Hamas or to the UNRWA, Arab respondents gave an 85% approval to 13% disapproval rate. Left Jews gave a 59% approval to 39% approval rate. Disapproval rate. Now, center Jews gave a 44% approval to 51.5% disapproval rate. And right wing Jews gave a 19% approval to a swooping 80% disapproval rate. Now, the results of the Israeli entity survey came as the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, said in a recent report that 550,000 people in Gaza are currently facing catastrophic food insecurity levels. Now, let us move on to the most notable exposé voices for this week. Imagine you are at home with your wife and children. It's dinner time before you put your three children to sleep. The room is cold, the propane cooking cylinder is empty, and there is no food, no electricity, and no drinking water. This is Gaza. Gaza is starving. Starvation in Gaza is not due to a drought or natural disaster, but it is rather an Israeli entity-made catastrophe enabled by the U.S. Biden administration. Rana Umeish on Instagram shared a video by a Palestinian displaced resident of Gaza who wept while telling us about the last meal he had. For famine to be declared, at least 20% of the population must be suffering extreme food shortages, with 1 in 3 children acutely malnourished and 2 people out of every 10,000 dying daily from starvation or from malnutrition and disease. But in late December, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, IPC, said that the situation in Gaza has already exceeded the 20% threshold. Now, as the United States airdropped aid into the Gaza Strip, its parachutes, like those of the other participating countries, brought only a tiny fraction of the aid needed for the 2.2 million Palestinians trapped without food, water, or medical supplies. However, never in a million years would have anyone thought that the U.S. dropped food aid would be expired food. Yes, you heard that right. Let's hear Bobby's voice on TikTok.
38,000 expired meals. The Biden administration just dropped 38,000 expired meals into Gaza. I quite literally don't even know what to say about this. Like, to be that vile and foul of a human being, if you can even call yourself that, to send people who are actively starving to death food that is actively dangerous, that is expired, that could poison them. You are not only, you're not being complicit in genocide. At that point, you are actively taking part in it.
Indeed, they are. Now, ladies and gents, with that, we conclude our expose for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Expose. The truth is just a revelation away.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke recently by video link to an APEC summit taking place just outside Washington, D.C. APEC attendees applauded his pursuit of genocide in Gaza, where tens of thousands of Palestinians have been martyred, neighborhoods wiped out, and the Zionist regime military has overseen starvation policies now taking the lives of Palestinian children. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Netanyahu has received the staunch support from President Joe Biden. The American president has noted some reservations at times, expressing consternation at the Zionist regime's indiscriminate bombing and over-the-top conduct in Gaza. But so far, Biden has kept the weapons flowing to Israel. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is most unlikely to stop the delivery of weapons now that Yoav Gallant, the Zionist regime's war minister, has signed a letter to the Biden administration with empty assurances that the weapons will be used in accordance with international law and that the U.S. humanitarian aid will be allowed into Gaza. This was, after all, already supposed to be the case. According to the Washington Post, the U.S. has approved and delivered more than 100 separate foreign military sales to Israel since October 7th, including thousands of precision-guided munitions, small-diameter bombs, bunker busters, small arms, and other lethal aid. For re-election purposes, Biden understands to say one thing, while quietly belying the words with actions facilitating the Zionist regime's war crimes. Biden's weekend comment about a red line on an Israeli invasion of Rafah, the last so-called safer area for Palestinians in Gaza, appears meaningless. He immediately self-corrected to note, "I'm never gonna leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical," unquote. Netanyahu, for his part, wasn't having even a little of it, declaring, "We will go there," he added. "You know, I have a red line. You know what the red line is? That October 7 doesn't happen again, never happens again," unquote. Red lines about the Zionist regime's apartheid and war crimes, however, are scarcely broached by mainstream Western media. The Zionist regime's prime minister continued with a similar line of thinking at AIPAC, pocketing Biden's support and indicating he would nevertheless do what he wants with American weapons. He said, "I deeply appreciate it, the support we've received from President Biden and the administration, and I hope it will continue. But let me be clear, Israel will win this war no matter what." The key words, though, unbelievable, are these: "We will finish the job in Rafah while enabling the civilian population to get out of harm's way. We've taken measures to minimize civilian casualties that no other army has taken in history." Yet those supposed measures involve the killing of well over 12,000 Palestinian children. Even if CNN couldn't bring itself to note clearly and repeatedly that the Zionist regime is the power killing them in a recent segment on Palestinian children. Jake Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor, also speaking recently, said that the path to securing stability for Israel does not lie in smashing into Rafah, where there are 1.3 million people, in the absence of a credible plan to deal with the population there. And again, as things stand today, we have not seen what that plan is. But he refused to speculate on whether the U.S. would condition military aid to Israel if Netanyahu disregards Biden's mealy-mouthed warning and attacks Rafah and the Palestinians seeking limited safety there. In other words, if hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who have faced 5 months of bombing and deprivation are not moved out of Rafah before an Israeli regime offensive, then the Biden administration may or may not take action regarding weapons to Israel. It's all words with no meaningful consequences as of yet, except that key constituencies are abandoning Biden and the Democratic Party. And if Palestinians are moved to the north, where the bombed and destitute are starving, the Biden administration is signaling that would be acceptable in the midst of what the International Court of Justice has deemed a plausible genocide by the child killer regime of Israel. AIPAC lobbyists spend part of their day pushing for additional military aid from the U.S. in order for the Zionist regime to prosecute the Gaza genocide unencumbered by a weapons shortage. Code Pink activists were there to challenge them, At least one irate AIPAC lobbyist ripped up a photo of starving Palestinians. Another argued that the Zionist regime could have turned Gaza into a parking lot had it wanted to do so and was rightly told that it had done so. Congressman Max Miller, in fact, early in the assault on Gaza, called for turning it into a parking lot. An AIPAC lobbyist attempt to get Code Pink activists thrown out for exercising their First Amendment rights in trying to stop a genocide. Code Pink co-founder Media Benjamin told the Electronic Intifada that while they weren't thrown out of the Capitol building, they were forced from the grounds. Benjamin wrote in a message, "There is a vast chasm between what the president says and what he is doing. Just like thanks to AIPAC, there is a vast chasm between what the American people want, a ceasefire and no more weapons to Israel, and what Congress is doing." The response to Code Pink activists made clear that genocide promotion in Gaza is going and being pursued by AIPAC lobbyists seeking more U.S. weapons for the Zionist regime's ongoing bombing and decimation of the coastal strip of territory and its people. Yet many Democratic candidates continue to embrace the financial support of AIPAC's Super PAC, United Democracy Project, and are likewise complicit in the Zionist regime's actions in Gaza. Even Politico, apparently beholden, though not yet pledged, to a code of conduct supporting the right of existence of the Zionist regime, even as an apartheid regime that is carrying out genocide in Gaza, has acknowledged that AIPAC is expected to spend $100 million across its political entities in 2024. Taking aim at candidates they deem insufficiently supportive of the Zionist regime. In 2024, many Democrats are proudly taking AIPAC's money to undercut candidates who would actually do what Americans want, back a ceasefire.
Covering Islam.
After birth, death is the greatest event in every person's life. It is the most private experience of every individual that cannot be shared with anyone else. Their death is followed by the destruction of the body as we know. However, would that mean the total destruction of the person? Why do we die at all? What is the philosophy of our temporary life on this earth? Why is death so scary for many people? Is the dichotomy of soul and body true? And if that is the case, what is the soul and how would it leave the body? There is one thing that we can be certain of, it's that we will die. Yet death remains one of the greatest mysteries that man has ever known.
There is a definition of death which doctors give us, which is when the brain waves or the electrical waves in the brain stop. That would be counted as death.
Scientifically, death is the cessation of all biological functions that maintain a person. Roughly 150,000 people die around the world each day, so it should be one of the most familiar subjects for all. Most people wish that they never have to think about it or face death, and they're even scared to think about it.
If you ask someone to enter a room and no one would be able to leave that room and come back and give you an experience of how it felt to go into that room, many people would hesitate to enter that room. In the same way, when it comes to death, many people who have died and none of them have returned back to life to give us or share with us how they experienced that death or where did they go. So it's a transition to, for us in this world, and for many, somewhere unknown.
The word death conjures up an idea of the end of things. When we use death in English, we say when something dies, it seems to us almost to mean that it is now useless. It can be discarded. It has no value. It has lost its vitality. But it's not a very good word, or it hasn't taken a very good meaning in that way, because in Islam, death is a transference, according to many hadiths, from one abode to another abode. It is like walking through a doorway. If you call a doorway death, fine. It certainly is not an end to life. It is a continuation to life.
You know, we can understand why people find it uncomfortable to talk about death. And one of the reasons is because of the intense love we have for the world. And death signifies a departure from these attractive, beautiful things of the world.
All cultures correspond death with frightening thoughts and images. The reason for that is because we look at it from the departure side, because we are scared to leave what we are very much familiar with to the unknown. However, if we were to see it as an arrival, we find it to be more of a blessing than a loss.
It's a shedding of clothes. It's taking, I don't know, you can say a shower and cleaning the filth from your body. So in other words, it's an existential thing. It's not absence of something. Unlike what we are brought up being taught, or directly or indirectly, about how death is absence of life. No, life, as we know it, is something that has different stages in Islam. So it's not that we have life and then death. Life continues. We just have to shift. We have to cross the bridge. Imam Hussein alayhi salam on Ashura, he would tell his companions that be patient. Death is nothing but a bridge where you're crossing to go to the better stuff, to higher levels of existence and life actually.
We are born for eternity, and death, unfortunately, is taken negatively as if it means the end. The Islamic explanation is that death is just a transfer. It's a gateway to enter the second, or the stage after this current stage. Stage one is this life. Stage two is transition between this life and the afterlife, the barzakh. Stage three, eternity.
What's important to realize is it's all like what we call the circle of life. There was the side of the human being descending from the higher up to dunya. And that's why dunya is called dunya, because it's at the bottom of the cycle. Okay. And then it will start to ascend back again to where it came from, and that's when the soul is separated from the body and the nafs goes back. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un.
Yeah, Islam's picture of life and death is part of a broader process, part of a bigger process. It is simply a gateway into that which is to come.
Death is really the bridge that unites the lover with his beloved. Meaning that, you know, man who loved his Lord, he now wants to meet his beloved, his creator.
Man is a traveling creature. He starts from a drop to clinging mass, to a fleshy tissue, to a fetus, to a baby, to a child, to a youth, to an adult, to an elderly, and eventually to the grave. But is the journey going to stop here? Is this the end? Or there are other stations to this uninterrupted journey?
We have a verse in the Quran, Ya ayyuha al-insan innaka kadihun ila rabbika kadhan famulaqih. O man, you're moving towards your Lord, you're traversing a path towards your Lord, and you will eventually meet Him. This shows that we're on a journey, and life is a journey, and it ends with meeting our Lord. Does this journey end with death? The answer to this is that if we look at what the definition was in the beginning of life, then we will understand that life doesn't end with death, and since life doesn't end with death, and is continuous, then so the journey continues as well.
The baby's journey to the world is full of wonders, and the elderly travels to the grave is even more wondrous. Now, based on Islamic teachings, death is ripeness of the soul, and its readiness to be picked and initiated into the wonders of a new life. It is the tunnel to a phenomenal world of wonders.
The death, as we know it, is not an end to life. Rather, it is a portal, a doorway into a new and more expansive existence. And indeed, as we move on in this journey from this dunya into barzakh and then later on to the day of judgment, we are constantly evolving and changing. We're not dying.
But where is the destination of this journey? How many more stations are out there? Where is the map for this long travel?
We're here for eternity. We're born for eternity, not for death. Yes, since death is going to take us closer to that eternity, then in a sense you can say we're born to die. But not we're born to die in the sense that we are born for absence of life. No, we are born so that eventually we will be transmitted from one level of existence in life to the next level of existence in life to eventually attain that eternity we were born for.
Some say there is no afterlife, but they only assume. And why should we follow their assumption? Why should we think that this journey should stop so abruptly? Why should man, this traveling creature, stop traveling? If he were to stop, why did he set out? Why shouldn't we follow those who claim knowledge of that side and listen to those who only assume?
Somebody recently sent me a picture of twins in the womb of mother. One of them arguing that there is no life after birth, another saying there is life after birth. So in the similar way, we are in this world. Those who believe, they are arguing there is no life after this world, and others saying there is life after this world.
I believe there is an afterlife, but I believe it cannot be objectively proven. It is something which you need to go inward through introspection, through interaction with Allah, and seeing the signs in your life. I believe the afterlife can be discerned from this life itself.
We started from that drop of water, and we are where we are now. However, for the final destination, we need more progress. The Quran gives us some preview of what we may expect in our progress into future. We have to be prepared for that great encounter, meeting with the Lord, the Creator. He wants to share with us what he has. وَبَشِّرِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ بِأَنَّ لَهُمْ مِنَ اللَّهِ فَضْلًا كَبِيرًا. He loves that you live beside him, pure and honest.
في مقعد صدق عند ملك مقتدر. He's waiting to meet you and to live with you forever. خالدين فيها نزلا من عند الله.
Death is an astonishing pass through the world of wonders. Some people have had flavors of that adventurous dimension on many instances of near-death experience.
Near-death experience is a personal, involuntary experience in which the person will see itself outside the body and while in a condition of a crisis like an accident or a surgery, and the person will be considered clinically dead, but then eventually the person will come back. And in the case of the near-death experience, the person will have a recollection of what happened during this period in which he or she was completely considered dead.
In his book, Life After Life, The Investigation of a Phenomenon, Survival of Body Death, the American psychologist and medical doctor Raymond Moody has compiled huge data and presented extensive analysis on near-death experience. He's classified the experience of 150 patients with near-death experiences into several categories. Now, one group experienced that they left their bodies while they were absolutely conscious and could observe the efforts of the medical team. Another group felt that they were okay in a body different from their physical body. Now, Moody uses the term spiritual body for this.
In the case of the near-death experience, it happens when the person is close to death or when this person is actually considered dead, which means no heartbeat, no brain activity whatsoever. So in this case, what happens is that the person will experience different things that we cannot see here, and the person will normally have some characteristics. For example, the person will hear sometimes noises that we call it intracranial sounds. It just happens inside of their heads. Then normally they see a tunnel. Many times they see a light at the end of the tunnel. So they float, or sometimes they just go quickly towards the light.
Other experiences implied losing the sense of physical time, peace and tranquility, confusion as a consequence of leaving the physical body. Another group reported that they saw a prominent religious personality in a body made of light.
Some others stated that initially they did not realize they were in a new body until they found out that the hearing and their vision of their relatives was too weak to see or hear them, although their own senses had intensified so that they could hear and see new things.
What these studies tell us is that firstly, our knowledge about human being is much less than what we assume. And secondly, we have to confess that our current scientific tools are inadequate for these novel areas of research. And finally, and most importantly, not everyone has the same experience of death.
يَعْلَمُونَ ظَاهِرًا مِنْ الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا, the Quran says. People appreciate only very surface aspects of the creation. وَهُمْ بِالْآخِرَةِ هُمْ غَافِلُونَ, and they're oblivious of the expansive nature of what I have really created.
Generally, death is an experience similar to the birth of a baby, where it travels from one world to another. The difference, however, is that the baby cannot remember anything from its previous world, while the baby's soul is extremely astute and can feel the difference.
By entering into that realm, the soul moves one step closer to its completion, and its power to comprehend the realities of existence would increase.
Hence, it is now one stage nearer to the final destination, meeting with the Lord. A meeting which is not like meeting of a person with another person, but meeting of two worlds.
The whole purpose of this worldly life, this transient, ephemeral and fleeting 70 or 80 years, is that we prepare our souls, we make them ready and fit for the divine proximity and divine neighborhood, so that we become the neighbors of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We become fit to have that beatific vision in paradise.
The soul is very difficult to define, but in a simple expression, it is what we call I, the one who wills, who decides, who judges, who loves and hates, the one who uses the body as a means towards its end. We usually think that these are functions of the mind, while the mind is a simple conglomeration of absolutely separate cells.
We have to see what defines a person. Is it the body, or is it the me within the body? When we're growing up as kids, we have that me in us. As we grow older, we feel that this same me that I had when I was a kid is still that same me. Of course, experiences are added to me, but the me is the same me. We can't fool ourselves. As we grow older and older, the same me again and again. So, does the person die? We have to see. The body will die for sure. The body is destroyed for sure, but the person, no, the person will live on. That me, or in other words, the soul, is going to live on.
Meccans asked the Prophet, tell us what the ruh is, what is the spirit? He said, يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الرُّوحِ قُلِ الرُّوحُ مِنْ أَمْرِ رَبِّي. They ask you about the soul, what it is. Tell them that the soul is my Lord's command. And that's all you can understand. You can't understand more than that. And of course, you know, when I say you can't understand more than that, you know, some people will say, well, we live in a very enlightened age of science and technology and information, and we have everything on our fingertips. But let me tell you, you know, the best minds in physics, the best minds in biochemistry, the best minds in genetics, best minds in technology and engineering and in every field will say to you, we only know this much. We only know this much of the physical world.
It is true that the soul knows this world by the help of body and its different organs. And if it was not for the body, the soul would have not known anything. It is as the Quran mentions, وَاللَّهُ أَخْرَجَكُمْ مِنْ بُطُونِ أُمَّهَاتِكُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ شَيْئًا وَجَعَلَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَالْأَفْئِدَةَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ. God has brought you forth from the wombs of your mothers while you did not know anything. He made for you hearing, eyesight and hearts so that you may appreciate. Mutually, if it was not for the soul, the body would not have been able to do anything. Death happens when the soul leaves the body. The question is, what would the soul do without the body, which was its only means to every end? The answer is that it lives in another body.
When you die, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts your soul in another body. Now, let's say it like this. You have a body once you die as well. And you will eat, you will drink, and so on. Or you will be punished to an extent. And this is called the mithali body, they call it. Which means that you have that same shape and form, but you don't have material anymore. Okay? So you have height, width, maybe length, but you don't have that material. Okay? It's not something tangible. And that's why we, in this realm of life, we can't see those who have passed away.
The soul is the real us. The body is a vehicle. That's why when, for example, we look in the mirror and we say, I, we don't mean this body with its limbs. If we were to lose a hand tomorrow and look in the mirror, we'll still say I and mean the same thing. We won't say I less five fingers. So we have an understanding of the real us, who we refer to as I. This soul requires, depending on which environment it is in, a body of sorts, and there will be a more subtle body that it occupies as it moves on into Barzakh, and an even more subtle body that it occupies when it moves into the Day of Judgment.
Death is really a move from one realm of existence into another. It is moving from the physical world, the material world, the touchable world, the tangible world, into the realm of spirit, the realm that is spiritual, the realm that is beyond and above the laws of physics, really. Gravitation or material or physical things actually don't exist in that world. It's a world of its own, with its own laws and with its own way of operating.
That spiritualistic communication or spiritualistic sense is simply that sense which is not materialistic, the sense which is got that third component, if we may call it.
Rumi refers to these senses in his famous book Masnavi. There are five senses other than these five senses. Those are like red gold, while these are like copper. The prophets communicated with the angels through these senses, and the Prophet of Islam went to Mi'raj, the ascension, with his spiritual body, and heard and saw things by his spiritual senses. These senses will be activated for all after they die.
In this world, the soul is not able to manifest its true potentials. It is governed largely by the constraints of the material world around it. And it is an uneasy, if you like, passenger in the vehicle that is the body. However, there is a purpose to this existence, and the soul requires to have this phase of its existence. But it really, if you like, flies and flourishes once it is free from that fetter of the body, and that is real life.
The spiritual body grows with us as we grow in this world. In fact, we have one aspect of this rooted in the middle world, and that is why we can communicate with that world in our dreams. So in this world, we live in two bodies, but since one is like an image of the other and completely matched on it, we realize that. Now, these two bodies belong to two dimensions of the same existence. On the moment of death, the soul discards its physical body and leaves this world with its spiritual body. So when we talk of death, we actually talk of ourselves in a new body, a body which is much more complicated and much more magnificent than our physical body.
The awareness, the power of the soul that is available to it, even in Barzakh, is exponentially different to that which was available to it in life. Even the kafir and the agnostic and the atheist, their ma'rifah and knowledge of reality is much greater than any scholar who's alive now, because the veils have been lifted and they see.
So every one of us leave this world in a spiritual body. A body which is lighter, fresher, and more agile than the body in which we are living now. A body with a special DNA partially created by us in this world. But what type of experience is death? Isn't going to be the same for all? Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk about this in more details. Until then, peace be with you.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity.
In the limelight.
According to a lawsuit filed by civil rights bodies, New York City's Suffolk County Police Department has been sued for forcibly removing a Muslim woman's hijab and withholding it until her release. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Middle East Eye has covered this story and tells us more. The New York City Police Department conducted a raid on a street in the borough of Queens just 48 hours prior to the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, targeting Bangladeshi street vendors who were selling Islamic merchandise. Based on a report by the city, the busy area in the New York City borough, known for its 12 vendors selling Islamic goods, was surprisingly lacking the usual crates and tables filled with religious texts, prayer mats, and hijabs on Thursday, 14th of March. Over the last 20 years, street vendors from Bangladesh in Jackson Heights, Queens, have regarded Ramadan as a crucial period for selling their goods and establishing connections with the Muslim community in the area. 55-year-old Muhammad Ashraful Biswas, who worked at a fried chicken restaurant before taking over the business in 2008 from his father, who became one of the first street vendors selling Islamic goods in Jackson Heights 2 decades ago after realizing there weren't stores retailing them, said, "Police did not come since about 2 years ago." Muhammad Biswas went on to mention a recent incident when police officers gathered vendors on the block and gave him a $250 fine for street vending without a license. He recounted, "He told us, if you sell again, we'll pick up all your business staff." Of the several vendors who were targeted, many have lost their only source of daily bread, leaving them struggling to make ends meet in a city that is one of the most expensive cities in the world amidst the cost-of-living crisis. The raid came ahead of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan, a month synonymous with fasting and good deeds, when people come together to help each other with their difficulties in life. Street vendor MD Nasiruddin, who supports his family of five, including his 3 younger siblings, told the city, "My biggest fear is that I'll get arrested for working without a license. I'm afraid I won't be able to help my family or provide for them anymore. That's my biggest fear." According to Nasiruddin, it's almost impossible to get a vendor's license, as there is a wait list of more than 11,920 people already waiting to attain it. Apart from this, the license has since decades been capped at 853 citywide for non-veteran sellers. He started selling goods after being laid off from his position at a grocery store in 2020, during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic. After exploring job opportunities in Jackson Heights, he eventually came across street vending whilst interacting with other vendors of Islamic products. Another business owner, MD Ali, a 63-year-old, said he has longed for the opportunity to engage in bargaining with his fellow Bangladeshi, Indian and Pakistani community in the locality. He pointed out that during the blessed month of Ramadan, he typically succumbs to the anticipated and never-ending negotiations as a sign of goodwill. He said, "Customers keep asking us why we're not open and keep asking us to open regardless of the ticketing situation." According to a report, the city currently accommodates over 20,000 vendors, a significant number of whom operate without the necessary licenses. This license is mandatory for individuals engaged in selling, leasing, or offering goods or services in public areas that are not designated as stores. It has been more than two decades since the 11th of September 2001 attacks, yet Muslims in New York continue to experience trauma relating to Islamophobia, which they attribute to the New York Police Department, the very institution tasked with ensuring their safety. According to a December 2023 report by the New York State Bar Association, the Israeli attack on Gaza has led to a dramatic increase in hate crimes against Muslims in the United States. The American newspaper, the Miami Herald, has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a lawsuit filed by civil rights bodies, New York City's Suffolk County Police Department has been sued for forcibly removing a Muslim woman's hijab and withholding it until her release. The Council on American Islamic Relations CARE and Emery Sally Birkenhoff Abadi Ward Mazel LLP filed a lawsuit recently on behalf of Marowa Fahmi from East Setauket, charging that she was wrongfully arrested by New York police in 2022 based on a false tip. The Council on American Islamic Relations CARE, New York's legal fellow, Burhan Carroll, said, "The SCPD's hijab removal policy is inhumane, regressive, and clearly unlawful." The Council on American Islamic Relations New York asserts that the rights of Muslim Americans do not stop at the doors of the local police precinct. It said, "We will continue to fight on behalf of our community members who have been wronged by law enforcement. We hope this filing will result in justice for Fahmi and will protect others from future harm." According to the complaint, Marowa Fahmi's hijab was reportedly taken off during her arrest and was subjected to inappropriate touching by male police officers after she was forced to undress for a body search by the police department. She continuously pointed out that she could not be seen without her hijab, but her religious beliefs were disregarded by police officers as she was not provided with her hijab for a total of 9 hours. Nevertheless, according to the SCPD's Police 900.5-6, individuals are generally allowed to wear headscarves for religious reasons. The policy states, "Those who request to wear headscarves or simply head coverings for religious reasons should generally be accommodated absent unusual circumstances." Marowa Fahmi is now seeking compensation for a right violation and the emotional suffering that she had to go through. The ECBAWMM partner, Andrew Wilson, said, "What happened here was wrong. Religious practice and police practice are not incompatible. We are hopeful that this case can set a standard that requires Suffolk County police officers to protect the religious freedoms of New Yorkers who, like Ms. Fahmi, chose to wear religious head coverings." Marwa Fahmy's First Amendment rights were violated by the incident, as it violated her protection against unreasonable interference with her religious freedoms.